With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to episode 11 of The Story Studio with your hosts, Luke Condor and Daniel Wilcox. Oh yeah, here we go. Check it out now.
Welcome to The Story Studio, a podcast where an independent publishing company explores the world of self-publishing, independent art, and the future of storytelling. It's a show for filmmakers, writers, comic book makers, crowdfunders, entrepreneurs, creators, and anyone looking to tell stories in the modern world. My name is Daniel Wilcox, and today I'm joined by...
Luke Condor of K.
And John Locke is back. Our special guest today, John Locke, hey. 2.0 from Big Punch Studios.
Also with a K. Very, very happy to be here. He said, gesturing with his arms on a purely audio medium. So ooh. I apologize.
Yeah.
Not quite firing on full cylinders, but I will endeavor to be entertaining.
Yeah. Oh, great. This is an addendum to the previous episode, I guess. If you haven't listened to the previous episode to find out who John is, what he's all about, you should probably check that first and then come to here. Does that sound about right?
We've had some very nice feedback based on the previous episode, which has been lovely. Actually, you do all this waffling into a mic, and you're never sure how it's being received. But no, we've had some people say they really enjoy hearing about what we do at Big Punch, which is nice.
Oh, okay.
So, fantastic. So thank you, guys. Yeah, you're opening doors for us.
Oh, good.
Places.
Do you, out of curiosity, do you tell people that you podcast openly? It's something I tell people, but I have to figure out what kind of reaction I'm going to get first.
Like polite society?
Yeah, I would never. Yeah, I don't say I talk into microphones in my spare time to most people.
I think we may have touched on this recently. We may have touched on this briefly when we last spoke, but I think I'm reaching a point now where. I don't know if I'm proud of what I do, but I'm definitely less ashamed, if you know what I mean, of saying that I'm not an adult, you know. They say, what do you do? Say, well, you know, we write and we design some games and occasionally a podcast. And I'm getting to the point now where I can say that and people go cool. They're starting to maybe not understand it, but just not actively be scared of it anymore, which is nice.
There's a birthing period, isn't there, where you've got to kind of settle into admitting that you do it to yourself before you admit that you do it to other people. I think I'm still at that point with my work where I've only told a couple of people, and even those people that I've told have been podcast, it's nothing, it's stupid.
Yeah. The worst thing is when you have to explain what a podcast is, which is kind of crazy to me, the amount of podcasts I listen to. I thought it was, standard content now.
Well, it's weird. I mean, it's so weird. I listen to a lot less music than I used to now, and if I have headphones in all the time, so certainly when I'm doing the day job and editing, because I can kind of just isolate myself from the world. But more and more it's just podcasts on all kinds of stuff. I just enjoy hearing people talk. In fact, some of my favorite podcasts are the more aimless ones where it's just conversations committed to tape.
Yeah, any come to mind you listen to?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a gateway drug of mine into the world of podcasting was have you guys heard of Loading Ready Run?
I don't think so. No.
Well, Loading Ready Run are a Canadian based group of internet comedians, and very kind of indie. To be fair, I mean, I'm doing them a disservice. Like, they have probably hundreds of thousands of followers. Not quite millions, you know, not quite hundreds.
Yeah.
But they live off what they do. They have a studio, you know, really, really. They were a massive inspiration for me kind of getting started, because I know what they did was very different to what I was aspiring to do making comics, but I loved the fact that they were just doing it off their own back entirely. And they thought they're everything I aspired to kind of be as like an indie creator. And they just used to do kind of like in the kind of, when did the kind of podcast revolution start? It's probably about a decade ago. I mean, they were just, do like a monthly podcast, which was nothing more advanced than them all gathered in one room with a single mic, just kind of chatting about everything they'd done that week. And I think that's maybe where I got my love of just those informal conversations, because they just waffled on. And they don't do that anymore now. But in my modern podcasting, I started with the Kevin Smith podcasts because the man can talk and the man can...
and he's got a great voice. He's got like a really deep voice.
He really does. Yeah, it's crazy. And I loved his Fat Man on Batman podcast. I remember someone telling me about his Grant Morrison interview, and I'm just the most shameless Grant Morrison fan in the world. And
that explains a lot, by the way. After reading a lot of Big Punch magazine, I can see the influence now.
Thank you. Yeah, I kind of like shamelessly wearing that on my sleeve. But oh God, what am I listening to now? Do you guys know Scott Kurtz and Chris Straub?
I don't think so. Straub rings a bell, but...
Straub rings a bell, yeah. Well, they're both web cartoonists. And I think in that thing where, I guess, we're comic book makers. And I know you guys are working on a comic, so, you know, hey, one big happy comic family.
Yeah.
Comic book makers, they're definitely like web cartoonists. And Scott Kurtz did, and still does, PvP, which was like one of the first massive success web comic things, which is still kind of running today, and is one of the most visited web comics in the world. And Chris Straub is a fellow cartoonist who kind of like started out as a like he was a lot he was a degree younger than Scott Kurtz. He was kind of like his friend, but also like learning from him and kind of coming up. And over years, I have a massive man crush on Chris Straub. I should be honest about this, because he's really, really insanely talented. And the two of them are, and they're hilarious. And right at the moment, I've been listening to a couple of podcasts they did about 10 years ago. Like those episodes are still online. And it was called Web Comics Weekly. And it was, very much like the realities and kind of economics of making comics on an indie level. And again, slightly different to what we do. But there was a lot to be learned from it, and they're just very funny guys, and I could listen to them talk all day.
I could listen to independent storytelling type people all day as well. I think it's just that when someone's ethos resonates with your own, in day-to-day you don't really find people who do what you do very often. So it's nice to find people out there that are similar in a way.
I was gonna say, speaking of talking too much, I feel an important part of my brain isn't quite working tonight, like the bit that might normally tell me to shut up. So please do tell me to shut up. Otherwise, in this mildly delirious state of mine, I will just keep talking.
I'm not like
just have a signal, just both cover our cameras.
Okay, fine, right.
I'm not a professional interviewer, but I'm pretty sure telling the guest to shut up isn't the best interviewing technique.
It's an etiquette, yeah.
it'd be a hell of a statement.
Yeah.
The podcast I'm listening to at the minute, which I'm really enjoying, which I was surprised that I did, was, have you listened to any of The Walking Dave?
I've listened to the first few.
I think Luke will know a bit more. I mean, do you ever listen to the self-publishing podcast, John?
No.
Well, that's fantastic to listen to. It's three guys. It's Johnny B. Truen, Sean Platt, and David W. Wright. And David, I think about a year ago, he ended up in hospital because he's overweight and he's got health problems. So he decided to double his weight loss by walking around and recording a podcast as he does it. So while he's up in his half-hour walks, he kind of just talks about his life and things that are happening. And it's really weird, because that kind of stuff I wouldn't normally listen to, but it's so just raw and honest. And there are some hilarious bits in it. So I've listened to two episodes in a row where They're on completely different days, but as he's walking past the line of trees, he spots the same snake appear like 2 days in a row, and you just hear him stop talking and go, "Oh shit, there's a snake," and you go, "Okay." And then the next episode, exactly the same thing, but it's just one of those where he rambles about his life, but there are lessons in that where I go, "Yeah, it sounds a little bit like some of the stuff that I go through as, you know, an indie author." So
yeah, Dave Wright is quite an enigmatic soul, and he's quite interesting to listen to, just talk and waffle on.
I feel so ignorant.
He's an indie author, so he just writes fiction, like writes horror books.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, but he's a cool guy, though.
I've been, speaking of horror, like just because I was getting ready before speaking to you guys, I was listening to an episode of one of Chris Straub's kind of modern podcasts from like this year called Scared Yet? And he does an amazing webcomic called Brood Hollow, which is kind of like Tintin meets Cthulhu, which is probably like the best. I was doing it a massive disservice, but it's kind of fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And the artwork is deceptively simple, hence the kind of Tintin thing. And it's set in this kind of Prohibition era town in America called Brood Hollow. So it's kind of like this Stephen King-esque vibe and, you know, deep, horrible things beneath the town. But the main character, Wadsworth Zane, I want to say his name is, he's a door-to-door encyclopedia salesman who inherits, his great-uncle dies, he's the sole heir to whatever fortune he had, and he has to go to Brood Hollow to collect his inheritance, and ends up getting stuck there for various reasons. And he has OCD and obsessions and neuroses, and there are horrible things in the town. And every time these horrible, horrible things appear, the artwork shifts quite dramatically and goes from being like this really cutesy, almost childlike style to suddenly being very grim and scary. Like the monsters are quite dark. And so he's got, and it walks the amazing line between being very scary, but also very funny. It's, a humor horror thing at the same time. And and he does a podcast with another cartoonist called Abby Howard, who I'm not massively familiar with her work, but yeah, they've just been talking about things that scare them. Oh, sorry. And Chris Straub, he wrote the creepypasta Candle Cove. I don't know if that rings a bell.
It rings a bell.
This is the weirdest thing. Like, this is the era we live in. He wrote like a creepypasta, which was maybe like 400 words, if that, which was a fake message thread in a forum about people discussing a kids program they all remembered as from when they were children. And it was called Candle Cove, and people were saying like, "Oh yeah, that show used to terrify me as a kid. It was all these really creepy puppets and stuff, and this something called like the Bone Eater and stuff like that, which would just like utterly terrify them." And then loads of people realizing that that show never aired, but they all remember it. And someone said like their mom came in and they were just staring at a screen of static, that kind of thing. And from that, which was really just like a modern art installation. It wasn't even a story. It was like just a fake forum. That's now been picked up and is being made into a TV series. And
that's pretty cool.
It's absolutely bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. He's a very talented guy.
Yeah.
I have to check out some of his stuff.
Amazing.
I recommend Brood Hollow. So good.
Brood Hollow. We'll link all in the show notes again so people can check it out. John, I've got to quickly say congratulations because your Kickstarter campaign was fully funded.
Oh, good grief. Yeah, Flip, sorry. No,
have you forgotten?
Yeah, it's been a manic 2 weeks. It really has. But yeah, I got the email today from Kickstarter saying, you know, we've successfully processed all the funds and they'll be arriving soon. And we've got the first digital rewards out the door. So yeah, it's almost like it didn't happen. It was almost like a bizarre dream. But now, yeah, we're about to be full steam ahead on getting the rest of the book finished. Fantastic.
I've received some of my digital rewards, I think. So I've been reading Afterlife 1, Volume 1, catching up, and it's very cool. I actually really like the foreword as well. You have a little bit of a spiel talking about traveling across Canada and then wondering I think you were in a bit of an ennui about writing in general. Like, you didn't know if you wanted to continue, and then you sort of came back and thought, I'm going to do this thing that became Afterlife Inc. Does that sound about right?
Absolutely. I mean, it depends how much rope you want to give me, because I'll waffle on about Canada if you want. That kind of Canada was my kind of my formative year, I guess. I studied biological sciences at university. Stop me if I mentioned this in the last podcast. And as much as I loved it, I didn't think it was what was going to make me happy in my life. I still have a real soft spot for obviously science and biology in general, but I had to kind of take that long, hard look at myself and think, you know, what am I going to do with my life? And I realized I didn't think I would ever be an exceptional scientist. You know what I mean? Like, I thought, I'm good enough. You know, I'm kind of like a mid to upper echelon student. I'm not the best. I'm not the smartest. I think I could spend my entire life and maybe just be a kind of average scientist. But I have this feeling that, like, I may not be, I really thought I could bring something to telling a story. Like, I would never, ever say that I could write the best story ever, but I knew I could tell a John Locke story. Mm. And I knew that hadn't been done before. And I weirdly, for a kid who had very little confidence at all, like in anything, like no confidence in himself, I did have this crazy, presumptuous self-belief in my writing, which was kind of bizarre. Like, I felt John the person wasn't up to much, but I thought that John the writer could maybe be someone I would like and everything. Yeah. And that kind of, so I probably did the most daring thing I'd ever done in my incredibly boring, safe and well-behaved life. And I said, well, screw this. I'm running off to Canada for a year. And
did you write any of the book when you were in Canada, or did you come back?
I kind of started. No, because at the time I had this idea for a comic called Dark Force, which
I remember you mentioning that last time.
Yeah, the most 90s thing you've ever 90s. And I was in Canada. I was living in this kind of rambling shack of a house with nine other travelers. We had a terrifying landlady who lived next door. And shenanigans happened. We threw a house party. A wall got demolished in the lounge downstairs. That happened. And we were alternating above and below the breadline. I was thinking, oh man, it's so cold. It's so cold in Toronto in Christmas. And I'm like, what am I doing? How am I going to tell a story and get a comic off the ground? And I remember in the first week there was an indie little comic fair going on in a park around the corner. And I went along and there was some free comics you could pick up, and all the Toronto-based indie creators had put together a little anthology. And I had never even heard of Scott Pilgrim at the time, but there was a short Scott Pilgrim story in there about them, just the characters just getting sushi, that kind of thing. And I remember talking to these creators there, and I met Cameron Stewart, who was just kind of there in this tent in this park, and he was Toronto based. And I said, look, it's a bit presumptuous, you know, would it be all right if I popped into your studio one day just to say hello and kind of see what was going on? And he said, yeah, come on down. And I've been chatting on MSN Messenger.
Messenger.
In the head of the days, 2007. And I've been chatting with an artist called Keith, who was Canadian, and we met up when we were in Canada, and he became part of our friendship group, and we were going to make Dark Force. Dark Force was going to be us taking on the world. And I remember going to see Cameron Stewart, and he was saying, like, so what's your comic about? And I was trying to explain to him, and I couldn't, because it was about everything and nothing at the same time. Like, it was, you know, it was very, dare I say, kind of teenage, you know. It was kind of like, you know, it was angels and demons and this, that, and the other. And he was just like, and it's going to be 100 issues long, and it's going to be like Sandman. It's going to be the next Sandman. He was just like, okay, slow down. He's like, slow down, you know, start small. You're just going to kill yourself if you try to do all that before you can, you know, you go run before you can crawl. And around that same time, I popped along to, I'm worried I'm repeating myself now, but anyway, I got a lovely piece of advice from from the owner of a comic shop in Toronto called The Beguiling. And he told me there's nothing more overrated than a good idea, which was, it absolutely crushed me. It was the most devastating advice I'd heard, but it ultimately kind of saved me, I guess, because it made me stop and think and start from scratch. And then in that weird environment I found myself in, AFTL, I think, kind of blossomed, and I have utterly no idea where it kind of came from. So many of the characters just kind of sprung fully formed out of nothing. It's almost like I was, but everything I got caught up in had just become like a blockage. And the moment that was gone, I was like, oh, heck, I have an idea.
And have you still got ideas? Are you going to do any more after four?
Or? Oh, absolutely. No.
Okay, cool.
The most depressing thing, or the most, not depressing, the most maddening thing is that the original idea for AFTL, I think, which was born from that winter in Toronto, was that it would be six books. It would be six books in the style of, you know, the American graphic novels I'd grown up reading. And and it would be the rise and fall of AFTL, I think. And the original plan for the series was it would begin with Jack dying. It would end with an ending, like a very, very definite ending. And then it took me a very long time to actually get it off the ground from that original idea. Like Keith was too busy to ultimately commit to it. And I couldn't pay him at the time anyway. And it wasn't, so I spent a year of scheming. I had another comic I was working on in Canada. And of course, I didn't have an artist. It wasn't going anywhere. When I got back to the UK, I found a job. I started like saving up. And then I had enough money to pay my first artist. And we made the first story. But I realized I wasn't good enough as a writer to tell the story, the original arc of AFTL, I think I'd always wanted to. So I did one short story, which turned into two short stories, which turned into three, which inadvertently became volume one of AFTL, I think, which you've been reading. And then I ended up making a second book and a third book, none of which, he said in a very rambling roundabout way, were part of that original plan. None of them. So by doing all these kind of indie self-published stories, which I never imagined I would, now, finally, with book four, I'm coming around to where the original start of the series was. And the only difference now is that I'm not starting with the death of Jack. And so many people have said, oh, I love the way you never explained how Jack died. I love how you just dumped us straight into the action. And I'm like, oh yeah, that was totally my plan. In reality, I just started telling these side stories to a story which hadn't been made yet. It was almost like I thought I'd fake it till it started making sense.
I think we better jump onto the big whoops very, very soon. And then we'll talk about Patreon.
So sorry.
No, it's good. Cool. But I think the way you introduced the first story was a great introduction to the world and the sort of the theme and the humor behind it. So I think the way you started AFTL, I think one was a very good way to start a book. But big whoops.
Oh, what a big whoop.
Has anyone got one they want to start with? John, have you got a big whoop? Or Dan, do you want to go first?
Please, Dan, go first. Save me.
Okay. my big whoop will have to be one that I should have done last week, but I don't know why I didn't do it in the end. But it was that we all went to our first Comic-Con, not last, 2 weeks ago. It doesn't matter. It's on the podcast.
Yeah.
But no, we all went to our first Comic-Con in Lincoln, which was the Lincoln, puns. And it was kind of awesome. So it was basically, it was quite a small affair in terms of how Comic-Cons go, or a few that I've been to, but it was well organized. It was kind of a steady stream of people all day. And it was just really nice having our table, our banner, our books, and being able to stand there and talk to people face to face about what we do. Because obviously as writers, we spend a lot of time by ourselves or sort of away from people who actually understand or the people that would enjoy the things that we do. So yeah, it was just lovely just talking to the people. It was a really well-run event by two guys also called Luke and Dan, which was very confusing when they were announcing at the end to bring Luke and Dan to the stage to say thank you for everything they've done.
I feel like you're welcome.
Me and Luke just look at each other going, sure, yeah. But no, it was just fantastic. It was just motivating more than anything to want to fill that table with more stuff and just talk to more people about what it is we do.
Yeah, yeah. It was great. It's really fun.
Mm. A good stepping stone, I think, as well, to bigger cons, because it was quite, I wouldn't say it was tiny, but I'd say it was good enough for us first Comic-Con.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah. John, do you remember your first con, or how long ago was that?
I do. That was February 2012. And that was the inaugural London Super Comic-Con, which the big selling point was they had Stan Lee.
Yeah.
Basically. And not a whole lot else, actually. I think that's kind of why we ended up having quite a strong start, because I think there were so many people through the door who were like, oh, I can't wait to see Stan Lee. Right, I've seen him now. What now? And then there's like five tables in the corner and I was just kind of waving. And
he looks nice. Yeah.
I think my friend went to that comic. Well, my friend got tickets from his girlfriend to go to that Comic-Con. And he's a massive Marvel fan. He was just fanboying all over the fact he was going to see Stan Lee. And then discovered a week later that his parents had already booked for them all to go to Italy for that week. Oh, so he had to sell the tickets that his girlfriend bought him and never got to see Stan Lee.
I'm sure we'll get to see him at some point. No, he's not doing any more cons, I think. Is that?
Nope.
Never again.
Well, see, it's weird because I swear he's appeared at like three this year, unless he's fine. And then maybe now's the cutoff point. Or
they're the lookalikes.
Cosplay.
Cosplay.
It's funny, like some random con experiences, because I remember like at that London Super Comic Con where it was kind of empty. They had this big kind of warehouse and not much in it. There was a guy going around dressed as this amazing Galactus. So he had a tiny little Silver Surfer on his shoulder. So like my first kind of con experience, I always remember that Galactus.
Yeah.
And then I think the following year, we were at Kapow, a short-lived show, but I met this guy who was half Skrull, and he looked really cool, and he was a lovely guy, and I remember just having this really nice chat with him. And he just sometimes you just meet these most genuinely wonderful people, two of which I'm talking to right now, of course.
Oh, thank you.
And he was like, oh yeah, I was Galactus. I was like, oh yeah, you were there. You were like, you're just like this really ingrained memory now at that show.
Did he have a tiny person on his shoulder that was cosplaying as Silver Surfer?
Far away.
Yeah.
Very far away, and by clever tricks perspective, he always appeared from his shoulder.
Nice. I guess my big whoop, I have two, but one's just a very, very quick one. Just want to say the new Bon Iver album has nothing to do with storytelling or comic books, but I just can't stop listening to it. But my actual storytelling related big whoop is, do you guys know Valiant Comics? Do you know much about Valiant Comics?
A little bit.
Okay.
I want to say yes.
Okay. So there's the big two comic book publishers. There's Marvel and there's DC. And in 92, Valiant started, and the idea was to start a third big publisher. They had Ninjak, Bloodshot, Ray, Exo Manowar, all these characters, or Harbinger, all these characters that were very, very 90s, admittedly, like really super 90s, like mullets, long hair. Pretty amazing to look at some of those old ones. But then they went bust and they sold. They also had Turok and another big one that they've not been able to get back. Solar Man of the Atom or something like that. So they went bust. They sold a load of their characters and stuff to some other company who still got the rights to them. They're just not doing anything with them. But then in 2012, they relaunched with a whole new comic book line. Every single comic book is kicking ass. Archer and Armstrong. Are any of these names ringing any bells or...?
Yeah, I see him around. Do you know what's weird? I have this thing about Archer and Armstrong where I have no idea what it's about.
I think you would love Archer and Armstrong, by the way.
But the name always sticks in my... like every time I see it, it's like having something stuck in a tooth. You know, you just can't...
Yeah.
Something about the name, I'm always like, what is it? Like, what is it about? Like, it baffles me. I want to... It seems so weird that a mainstream comic is called Archer and Armstrong.
Yeah, it's kind of bonkers as well. It's about this immortal drunk guy and this kid who was raised, he's like a kid Christian assassin who was raised in a theme park where they trained little kids to believe in Jesus and go kill people who they didn't want. They had like a hit list sort of thing.
Amazing. And, sorry, I'm just looking at pictures on Google.
And then they just go on these crazy adventures. There's like zombie nuns. There's they go to a place called the Faraway, where there's a guy called General Redacted who, as you're reading the comic book, every other word is like blanked out because you're not allowed to see what he's saying. It's the it's the most hilarious comic book. It's written by Fred Van Lente, if you know Fred. But it's so good. But anyway, Valiant, so they've just decided to go all punk rock, and they decided to fund their own web series for their characters.
This is ringing a bell now.
Yeah, so it's called Ninjak versus the Valiant Universe. I think the idea is that they can't compete with Marvel's budget or DC's budgets to make their films, but they want to get involved in the live action scene, and they've decided to team up with a YouTube company called Bat and the Sun Productions, and they do Superpower Beatdown, which is where they get like the fan film. So they go Wolverine versus Predator, and they like film it all, really proper fight, and they have White Ranger versus Scorpion, all these crazy fights. So Valiant, I just love this punk rock attitude to saying, right, we're going to give this little indie film company a load of money. They're going to have full reign of our characters, and we're going to get our characters out to, you know, millions of people who are ever going to see it. But I just absolutely love this company. Bloodshot is, so Archie and Armstrong, read that. Bloodshot is great as well. I would recommend it totally.
I've looked at some of the panels just a second ago, and I've got to say that's going to be on my list for next read.
John, I'd recommend also Ivar Time Walker, which is like
sounds great title, yeah. Again.
Yeah. Yeah. I just love this company. I think you will look, if you looked into it a bit more. Yeah.
I certainly will. That's the best recommendation I've heard. I'll definitely check it out.
Cool. Okay. So we need to figure out Patreon. John is going to hopefully help us figure out Patreon.
Revamping. Yeah.
We tried. We failed.
We didn't try very hard.
We didn't try very hard,
but we tried.
Yeah.
I hope you don't consider me an authority on the matter, because I'd hate to steer you wrong.
Well, I think you're doing it in the correct and best way. You have a fan base. You have money coming in through the portal, whatever it's called. And I think you're the right guy to sort of show us what to do. Or could you explain Patreon to...
Can you be our Gandalf?
Yeah.
Can I be your Gandalf? I guess better than Radagast on a runaway. But no, sorry. Patreon, yeah. I guess in a nutshell, Patreon.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets, featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has 2 limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Is the sister service and kind of companion to Kickstarter in that it is a way for fans to give regular monthly payments to creators they follow. And I guess typically, but not essentially, these are smaller payments. So, you know, the typical model is you're giving a little frequently. But, you know, that isn't, you know, set in concrete. There are exceptions to the rule at all times. I find it fascinating. I genuinely do. Patreon in general.
It's a beautiful description, I think. It's probably the most succinct description I've ever heard of Patreon. So your Patreon campaign, it looks to me like you've anchored it around Big Punch magazine. Would you say that's correct?
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, I think that was the original idea because Patreon. I still feel as though the indie comic book, or maybe just comic books in general, are still kind of finding their feet with Patreon, and I know for a fact that we are as well. Like, you see the areas which are doing really well, or the creators that are doing really well on Patreon, and it's not comic books as such. I heard someone say once that Kickstarter lends itself more to a thing, a product, like one-off kind of, you're saying I saw like a Venn diagram of like, you know, how best to plan your crowdfunding or whatever. And if you're making a thing with a defined end goal, maybe Kickstarter is for you. If you are doing more of an ongoing thing, then Patreon is maybe for you. So I guess traditionally back in the day, people might just put stuff online for free. I think Patreon does lend itself so well to anything with an online component. I know that sounds kind of like slightly redundant because everything has an online component these days. But I think like you think about what you're creating and you think about the platform it's released on. And if it's going online regularly, then I think whatever it is, you're going to kind of do well on Patreon, I feel. I don't think the indie comic book scene has traditionally kind of fitted quite well into that model. And we started doing BPM nearly 2 years ago now. And we had this idea that we would do a regular print magazine, which was something that given the production cost of doing stuff on the indie level, that was quite hard. And it certainly hadn't been done too often on this small scale. So we thought, well, how are we going to do this? How are we going to make it work? And we wanted to offer it as a subscription, which again, to our knowledge, was not something which had really been done too much in the UK indie comic scene. I'm sure there's plenty of examples out there that would prove me wrong. But we set up a subscription and we had kind of two branches to that. One was through Moonclerk, which is it's just kind of a third-party subscription provider, which has the mechanisms to allow you to take addresses and payment details and everything. And then also through Patreon. And the way we broke it down, and we did originally shape it entirely around BPM, our magazine, the idea was that you could either subscribe through our website, in which case every 3 months, every time a new issue was made, £5 plus postage would go out as a subscription. Or because Patreon is monthly, you could, you know, become a patron and a smaller amount would go out every month, but it would equate roughly, you know, over 3 months to the same as getting an issue of BPM. And, and then we always said that any patron would also get kind of behind the scenes extras. And that was the original plan. And we've tried to refine it a bit since then. But I feel we're always kind of learning and evolving.
Yeah. I think, Dan, what is our new plan that we're thinking about? How would we best describe it?
So I think we're looking at what we did before was we kind of tried to launch it on the back of the success of the other stories and have it as a bit of a, you can get, it was like weekly in advance episodes of the other stories. You'd get exclusive sort of before anyone else, which didn't really take. But I think now what we're looking at doing is almost branding it as an exclusive insiders club. So you get a bit more of the backstage stuff. You get a lot more of the behind the scenes, as well as sort of extras that you can't get anywhere else. But not really kind of going over the top with it, just having it as if you're a super fan and you're really enjoying the stuff and you want more, here is this service where for an extra couple of dollars or whatever is on Patreon, you can get a bit more from us.
Yeah,
that's kind of how we're approaching it. Because I kind of feel like with some people, the minute you say Patreon, subscribe, whatever, people, one, might not know what Patreon is, so it's a bit scary. And two, people that do know, I don't know, it's almost like a buzzword that could put some people off of subscribing and becoming a patron. So we're going to try and, I think, brand it as a bit more of an insider's club.
It's really interesting because it's something we've been talking about a lot recently, and I'm sure other people arrived at this a lot earlier, but it was a revelation for us at least. But the psychology of it is absolutely fascinating, because I never imagined that anyone would want to give money to support it. I know it sounds daft, but like it always occurred to me that like I always thought for the longest time that like stuff online is kind of free. That's kind of a thing, you know, like if you were putting out a webcomic, for example, the traditional model was always you put the webcomic out entirely for free, almost as like a kind of speculating, and then you sell books off the back of it, and that's how you kind of, you know, make money. But of course I'm learning now that this is obviously a good thing, but it's coming round, and now kind of people are more willing to, I seem to want to keep giving money to support people. But the thing we're finding really interesting is because we started out making physical graphic novels and comics and going to conventions to sell them, and that was originally the entire backbone of everything we did. And you know, it was fine because we could kind of not really do much stuff for we started out making graphic novels, taking them to shows and selling them, which was kind of wonderful. That was a model which was working for us. But we're noticing now, as we say, try to expand and do stuff like Patreon, we're noticing that traditional audience, so say, and by which I mean kind of like a convention goer, and we would have returning fans. We'd have people who would come back at a show and say, oh, hey, haven't seen you since last year. What have you made now? Great, I want to buy that, which is wonderful. So we had a fan base which was very engaged at shows. But then we didn't necessarily have a lot of engagement online with them. And I think the thing we found with Patreon is that, well, we've had maybe kind of, I think kind of like moderate success with Patreon. You know, it's not kind of crazy money, but it's allowing us, on top of when coupled with our subscriptions, to keep doing fun stuff, and it's continuing to grow. But we found that like that audience, which was traditionally the audience we were reaching, the convention going audience, which would go and buy books maybe once a year, was not really the same audience which seemed to be kind of getting behind Patreon. Whereas I think like, and what we're trying to do now, just because, you know, we don't want to be dependent on shows for the rest of our lives. We'd like to have, you know, a kind of community and fan base online, which kind of ticks over all year round. And then we can go to shows because we want to, and because we like meeting our fans, and not because we desperately feel we have to in order to keep kind of the, you know, business side of things kind of ticking over. So it's fascinating. And I think the perfect counterbalance to that is to see the kind of money that, say, streamers are making, like game streamers. It's kind of crazy, actually. I know it's hard sometimes not to lose your mind with frustration when I know for a fact, please don't ask me how I know this, but I know for a fact that there is an erotically charged artists whose work predominantly revolves around hobbits.
Wow, okay.
So let that sink in for a minute. Who is making something in the region of $10,000, if not much. Well, I know that's a minimum, a month.
Yeah.
On Patreon. So
it's difficult not to look at that and sort of get...
Question what you're doing.
Yeah. But I mean, like, it's the same on like Steemit, and it's the same on like, you know, Amazon, Kindle Publishing. There's always going to be unicorns who are making a ludicrous amount of money for what might not seem that much like work, or I don't know. I don't perceive the quality, I guess, as much as other people would. But it's disheartening. But I guess you sort of have to, you know, get the blinkers on and not focus on that, and just focus on what you're doing. And
no, I guess down that road, madness.
Yeah, exactly.
Madness lies.
Yeah.
Although I will, it is interesting because the idea we had, and certainly because we were doing a print publication with BPM, the idea was that like anyone who was backing us as a patron or subscribing, it was something we would send people magazines each year. That was the idea, and I think it added up to something like over 180 pages of full color physical comic, which we thought was a pretty good, you know, we're sending out a lot of material. And then it's like, at the same time, I know an example of someone who plays video games on Twitch, and their only Patreon tier is give me $25 a month and I will keep playing games. And I'm like, what are you getting out of that? Like, this is me being a grumpy old man who doesn't understand the kicks, because it's incredibly entitled of me, and people can spend their money on whatever they want. But at the same time, I'm like, seriously, what are you getting?
I completely agree with that. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people who I might be sort of generalizing, and sorry if I offend anyone that is listening, but I feel like people that watch people on Twitch playing games are those people that don't appreciate what goes on behind it. So obviously when it comes to things like Big Punch, when it comes to things like Hawk and Cleaver, we put hours into the background trying to produce things that are of quality, but all people care about is the end result. So sometimes people just like to watch people kick ass on games.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's a big audience for that, which I'm the same as you. I won't understand in the slightest, because I'm much more of a player than a watcher. It just doesn't make sense.
I think like I heard someone make a really interesting point the other day about how, in their opinion, there were three types of, I don't want to say people, but you know, you could get like creators who were kind of like actively making new stuff. Obviously, the name is pretty self-explanatory, or content generators, into which they kind of grouped people who stream. It's kind of like, or people who do, say, YouTube commentaries. It's like you're kind of creating something new, but it's more like you're repackaging something that kind of already exists. So, for example, it would be doing a YouTube series in which you are dissecting or commenting on movies or that kind of thing, or, you know, playing video games for entertainment purposes. It's like what you're doing is entertaining, but it's not kind of ultimately creating anything new. And then the third category was kind of like curators, which they kind of took to be people kind of like doing like fan art, like logos, kind of like a t-shirt, which is like a mashup of Doctor Who and the Triforce or something like that. Like it's kind of, or list generators, like it's you're kind of assembling content, but it's coming from other places. And it's interesting, and this is maybe like a very half-formed theory that I'm kind of putting together, but I am noticing a lot at the moment that we seem to be a lot of interest in content generators, content creators, and curators over actual creators. I think it's like the age of the remix, the age of kind of like taking existing content, changing it around, putting it back out. And I worry that like we're at the point now where we're just kind of repackaging existing stuff and rewarding that, and not kind of rewarding brand new creators. And I think like maybe in 3 or 4 years' time will be like, oh heck, we've run out of stuff to reference. We need to get some new DVDs again. Yeah.
I do think I think all three have value. I think curation, especially in Amazon publishing, is not there. I know there's people doing book reviews and they're like, you know, doing awards for the best 10 horror novel indie novels that year or something. But there's just so much content out there that it's very difficult for those people to find the kind of books that they want to read. But I guess, I mean, I was just going to say, do you think it's worth having a foot in each of those pies within like a publishing company? So does that metaphor even work? So like you have your curation, so you make your original content, you have a bit of commentary. So we've dabbled with this, a bit of a game play along type thing. And then I guess a bit of curation, we've not really done much of that, but I'm just wondering.
I mean, you could kind of say that the books that we write, the basis of what we do a lot of the time is it's X meets X. Even though you're creating something new, the original idea is kind of founded on ideas that have pre-existed.
I
agree entirely. And this is where I hope I don't come across as too much of a grumpy old man, because there definitely is merit, absolutely merit in all of them. I think there are obstacles in your way if you are a creator, particularly a small creator, because I think even though I don't know if we're still feeling the effects of like the economic crisis from a few years ago, but people are very selective about the things they support, and they're very, people seem to like familiarity. So there's always like, I think maybe once upon a time the new was kind of exciting. I think the new can be a little scary nowadays. And I think, sometimes you have to do what you can to survive. I mean, I think a good example of this would be Loading Ready Run, who I brought up earlier. And initially, they were creators. They were making a weekly comic sketch. I think they were doing about 3 or 4 videos a week. And they did that kind of predating YouTube. They were very, very much some of the early pioneers of that kind of thing. But in recent years, they have basically had a sideline in streaming. They're doing video games and watching them. And we followed them. We would we watched them because we enjoyed them as people. But it's like, it's interesting to note that I think over time, the amount of actual creation they've done has started to diminish, and the amount of time they spend streaming has gone up. And it's interesting because I know for a fact they make more money now off the back of streamers and of them being streamers. And I'm very happy for them because they're nice people and everything. But it's interesting. You sometimes wonder if you're going about things the wrong way. You think like if we were, you know, maybe it'd be nicer if there were some things which were, you know, if we had something which was like a moneymaker, which would kind of like allow us to support the other stuff. Because, I don't know, I know I'm rambling. It's a bit of a vague thesis. I just think there's interesting questions. I guess you kind of need to ask yourself about what you are and what you're trying to do and ultimately what you would be satisfied with. Because I guess, and a very good thing I heard said the other day is it's not about having the most followers. It's not about saying, I want a million, like I want a million active subscribers or whatnot. It'd be much better to have a small but engaged fan base. Like having, if you had 100,000 visitors to your website every day, but I don't know, none of them were interested, like really buying anything you did, then, you know, but if you had say 200 dedicated fans who were like, we love you guys and we'll buy everything you do and we'll give you, and we're happy to become your patron and give you some money every month.
Have you seen, do you know Kevin Kelly? He's the editor of the Wired magazine and he's and a futurist. He's a really cool guy. I think they call him the most interesting man in the world. But he wrote a blog post a few years ago. It's pretty internet famous now. It's called 1,000 True Fans. And he basically surmised that, if you had 1,000 fans who would buy everything you do, follow you around and would be completely engaged, you could make a full-time living. Like, he went into quite a lot of detail in some of these in his post, but it sort of made sense. Like, you don't want millions and millions of fans, although having a million is probably going to give you more true fans as well.
It's better for people to find you if you want more numbers, isn't it?
But you don't need the massive amount. You just need good people.
Do you think this is one of the things about Patreon itself is that I think, because I launched my own Patreon for my own writing a couple of months ago and it didn't do as well as kind of hoped it would.
Hmm.
But it's one of those things that it's a lot slower in success because people who invest in you are the people that want to see it long term. It's not like, like you say, with Kickstarter, you pay $10 and in a month, that's it. It's people saying, I'm going to give you my time and my money regularly for the foreseeable future. And if it is a slower building, essentially, that's fantastic because that proves and shows that that person is more of a fan than, say, someone who will just buy a book and then walk away.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting because I think, I think as a creator, certainly as an indie creator, it doesn't hurt to have one.
Yeah.
And I think as with Kickstarter, and I think it's something I've definitely noticed this time around with Kickstarter, it's not a magic wand for success. And I think it's interesting that like when Patreon came around, and if you were to kind of look at some of the real success stories on Patreon right now, I would argue that they were established, or you know, they had
pre-existing
before Patreon came along. And I think it's very hard to start from the bottom and work your way up. And I think kind of patience is essential. And I think kind of having one is by no means a detriment. But as you said, like it's interesting because you get one and you think, oh great, like this could change everything. But I think this kind of goes into, I guess, kind of who you are as a creator or who you all are as a group of creators, and also who your audience is. Because I think one thing we've noticed with our Patreon, and something we tried to kind of rectify, is that originally it was very focused on BPM, the magazine. So then, of course, if we had someone who was a fan of, say, Afterlife Inc., say they really enjoyed my work on Afterlife Inc., and they're like, well, hey, I want to support you on Patreon or something, but you've got this Patreon for Big Punch. And I'm like, where does Afterlife Inc. fall in that? And like, I don't really know what this BPM is. I don't really care about that, but I do love Afterlife Inc. or, you know, or vice versa, just as like an example. And I think your Patreon needs a focus. And that's something, you know, this is why I said, like, we've by no means mastered it, and we're going to continually try and evolve and improve. But it's interesting. Like we wanted our Patreon to kind of represent everything we did as Big Punch Studios. But then we think to ourselves, well, what do people know? What do people respond to more?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it could be argued that because Afterlife Inc. has existed longer than Big Punch, you know, maybe Afterlife Inc. is a better known brand, much as like Nick's Seven String had a life before Big Punch. So it's interesting. Like if you know, Dan Wilcox, Patreon, you know, it's like, are you doing a Patreon for Dan Wilcox, comma, writer? Or is it like, this is the name of one story I wrote, you know, or it's like the ongoing work of Dan, Dick Punch, like Private Eye or something like that. Like the most thrilling and his psychic matte finish. And they're just like, you know, they're going off and like saving the world. And people go, I love the ongoing adventures of Dick Punch. And
of Richard Punch.
Yeah, of Richard. Yeah, Richard Punch. And it's like, who writes it? Oh, I don't know, some guy called Dan. But I love Dick, you know, this is the thing. And it's like, and it's interesting because if you had, you know, if your presence as you yourself is strong enough, people are going to want to support that. And this is the thing. This is the balance you have to kind of strike.
Yeah. It seems to me like the first takeaway then is to find something to the best anchor for the campaign. It's going to be the biggest lure, but then you sort of want to have it expand outwards to be something bigger. And it's almost like, Your Patreon campaign should just be a platform to enable those 1,000 true fans to support you. Like you don't, you shouldn't be seeing it as a marketplace to, you know, find new customers and and build up your brand there, but it seems more of a place for people to support you and keep you going.
Yeah, and I think you know, a big thing is not being afraid to put your personality out there, because people are starting to realize, and maybe this is a turning tide, which is ultimately a good thing, that, you know, you're not robots who make these machines. It's like, people may love your books, but I think where Patreon will shine is where people go, I love the work of Hawk and Cleaver, but I love the guys who are Hawk and Cleaver even more. And I want to see them kind of, you know, succeed and have their success. And I think, I guess one thing which has always worked in our favor is that I think we've always been very, or tried to be at least, very sociable. I think, I guess it's hard on a Sunday morning at a con when you're kind of very grumpy and tired, but it's like, it's genuinely one of the greatest joys of creating has been meeting people at shows. I've absolutely loved meeting people and talking to them and knowing someone loves your stuff. And I think the only downside is what I mentioned earlier, is simply that I think the traditional, and I'm generalizing massively, but I think the traditional UK kind of comic buying scene has really yet to come around to Patreon as a whole.
Yeah.
And I think we'll get there. So I think at the moment, what you absolutely need is a web presence and community. And you need a place where people can come and find you daily, whatever it is you do. I think it's hard to do a Patreon if your fans can only really engage with you once or twice a year at a show.
Yeah.
I think whatever you do, be it Twitch streaming or crafts or writing or making comics, it's like you need someone where they can find you on a regular basis. And I think they need a reason to come find you on a regular basis. And, you know, if you're putting out your books on regularly or as installments or kind of like, I guess, serialized Arthur Conan Doyle style short bursts of microfiction and your podcast, that's the kind of thing which is really going to strike a chord.
Yeah. Fantastic.
I think also it's worth coming back round to the not making loads of money thing, is a lot of people, if somebody does decide to become a patron and they do just say, you know, a dollar for the tip jar, just topping up the tank, that even though it is just a dollar and that number doesn't look big, that's a fan. And that's a fan that through Patreon you have a direct connection to, because we get loads with the other stories. We get so many listeners that, you know, we're not going to know their names. We're not going to know who they are. They just enjoy what we do and they're in the background. But having that $1, just, I think it's important to appreciate that that is a person and that is someone who believes in you.
Mm.
Yeah. And I think that's probably ties into kind of like the next point I want to make, is that it's kind of, be it a Kickstarter, be it a Patreon, like in everything we do, we've always believed in trying very, very hard to treat our fans fairly, which is why I brought up the early thing of like someone giving you $25 a month to play a game. Like I've seen people, I support a few people on Patreon, and I've seen people offering, I feel, much, much more for much, much less, I feel, you know. So, which is why I think Patreon works best at traditionally these kind of low numbers. And we always wanted to give people extras. I mean, we're wheeling out some ideas where we really want to make our patrons feel special and feel kind of engaged in what we do. And so we've got a couple of things kind of in the works for next year. But yeah, we that anyone would back is, you know, a hell of an honor. It's the same with our subscribers. It really does make all this possible, you know, whatever all this is, you know.
Wicked. So we've gone over the hour again. But so we should...
I'm so sorry, guys.
No, of course not.
I really have been out of control tonight.
It's gone really quick. I've last minute put together some quickfire questions. So, John, if you're ready for a second round of quickfire questions...
Fire away. Hit me where it hurts.
Quickly, please.
Okay, Dan, do you want to go first?
After you, mate. You go first this time.
Okay, John, are you ready?
Yeah, born ready.
Carpet or floorboards?
Floorboards.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Last person you sniffed?
My friend trainer at his wedding at the weekend. He smelled like a champion.
What is the key ingredient of surprise?
Timing.
Did you know?
Yeah, I did.
David Blaine or Paul Daniels?
Paul Daniels.
What makes a good comic book?
Staples.
The best film sequel?
Oh, good gracious. I liked Age of Ultron.
Okay, cool.
I was that guy.
Spirit writer. I guess I know who this is now, actually.
Grand Rice.
Yeah, cool.
Spirit carbonated soda drink.
Ooh, tonic water.
Oh, lovely.
I love tonic water.
I enjoyed Age of Ultron as well.
Thank you.
I thought it's cool. I liked it.
We have our support group monthly where we talk about our love for a movie.
AA meeting, right? Age of Ultron. Oh, I didn't quite work.
The AA Ultron.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so where should we send people to this week, John?
Well, if they were kind enough to make it through another hour of me waffling, and I'm just going to keep apologising, but I hope I haven't come across as too much of a grumpy old man, because I just had random thoughts I wanted to get out of my head. But www.bigpunchstudios.com is the place for all things Big Punch, and I guess www.afterlife-inc.com as well, where we'll be getting some new content up on the site as well.
Great. And Dan, what are we, do you want to send people to this week?
www.hawkandcleaver.com. Put your email down, get yourself a free book.
Great. All right, guys, I'm going to stop the recording now.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Story Studio podcast. Still hungering for some podcast goodness? Then why not check out our other show, The Other Stories? Oh. And did you know, every time you leave us a review in the iTunes store, a puppy is born. Cute, eh? Anyway, toodle pip.